entertainment, sports, and radio's best guest list. Live from the Zone Radio Studios on Broadway on WZON Z62, WKIT HD3, and at downtownwithrichkimble.com. This is Downtown.
Well, hello there and a good Sunday morning. Welcome into the best of Downtown on this 18th day of the month of February. Rich Kimble, Kerry Haskell here with you. Downtown and the best of Downtown brought to you by Cross Insurance, where security meets strength. Guests of the program are heard every day on the G&M Family Market phone line. They're on the corner of Route 1A and Route 46 in Holden, open every day from 6 a.m. until 9 p.m. It's our weekly look back at some of our favorite conversations from the week that was. Made a little bit tougher by my illness, my general weakness as a human being, Kerry.
Yeah, you just have to, you know, one up. I had a cold. You ended up with
The flu and pneumonia. Yeah. Beat ya. I get all the good drugs, too. Wow. But we're back. It means, though, only 3 days to choose from. Now, the good news is, in those 3 days we had live shows, we had some quality content, and it was still tough to figure out who to put on the best of show. But we got some stuff for you, including our friend Alan Adams with movie reviews, Peter Rabbit, the new Clint Eastwood film, as well as John Corrales talking Celtics, author Michael Finkel discussing his wonderful book on the North Pond Hermit, Stranger in the Woods, and a certified music legend, one Billy Joe Thomas. All coming up this morning on the Best of Downtown. Let's get it rolling with some Celtics insight. It's the All-Star break. Celtics stumbling their way into the break, not playing particularly well. We talked about that earlier in the week with John Corrales of RedsArmy.com and the Locked On Celtics podcast. John, let's start not with the Celtics, but with the Cavaliers. Who were those guys?
They have made some significant improvements. It's such a weird story this Cavaliers season. You know, they brought in all of these new guys. They brought out, they kicked out all of the older guys, the guys who were causing problems in and out of the locker room. Now, on the surface, if you sit there and you say a team is turning to Jordan Clarkson, Larry Nance, Rodney Hood, and George Hill to save their season, that sounds ridiculous. But for the Cavs, when you put them around LeBron, first and foremost, but the other pieces that they have, eventually Kevin Love, J.R. Smith, the other guys, Tristan Thompson, those guys represent a significant improvement in athletic ability, in just all-out effort, and they improve the Cavaliers in areas where they were just incredibly deficient all season long. Their perimeter defense is now better just by default because everyone that they had on their perimeter was tied for the worst perimeter defender in the league, and they improve their age and athleticism. They just get a bunch of guys who try. And one of the biggest problems, maybe the biggest problem for the Cavaliers, is so many guys didn't try. So those two things are going to represent a significant improvement for the Cavaliers. And now the question is, in the playoffs, when they get there, and if a team game plans and takes Kevin Love out of the mix, and if they are somehow able to take one dimension away from LeBron James, who is going to be the Kyrie Irving who steps up and is that third option, that third star that they can rely on consistently? And that's going to be their biggest thing. Regular season, they've done a lot to improve. They're probably going to end up with the third seed because they're so far behind. Can they, from a Cavs perspective, get enough from one of these other guys? Can one of them go on a super hot run to take the pressure off of LeBron and Kevin Love? That's going to be the biggest unanswered question moving forward for them.
Celtics team has now lost 3 out of 4. I think in all three of those games, they've trailed at one point by 26 points or more. Is this just a bump in the road?
Yeah, right now it seems like, speaking of effort, it seems like there's a significant lack of effort right now. Could be the doldrums of January and February. It could just be guys that have been out and in the lineup. You add in the addition of Greg Monroe and trying to figure out how he fits, which leads to more lineup experimentation. There's a lot that kind of goes into something like this. I don't want to overreact to this stretch because every team, even the good ones, go through a stretch like this. We just talked about the Cavaliers gone through half a season on a stretch like that. And all of a sudden, everybody's just rejoicing at the additions they've made. Celtics have shown that when they try and they put forth the effort, especially on the defensive end, they've got a very good defense. And offensively, my biggest frustration watching that game against the Cavaliers is they just didn't move the ball from side to side. They didn't get a lot of touches in the paint. They didn't force a brand new defense to react and communicate and test their communication level. So I think the Celtics, if they get back to that, if they just get back to the simple ball movement, drive and kick, throw it into Al Horford in the post and run action off of that, they'll be okay. They'll go back to being okay. Maybe it's a simple case of they just need the All-Star break to come and they need to get more practices in and figure it out. I hope that's it, but I think, honestly, that the effort is the biggest culprit right now.
We're talking with John Corrales of RedsArmy.com here on Downtown. Well, the highlight of the weekend was the Paul Pierce ceremony. That was everything we expected and more.
Yeah, that was just – it was great. And you saw the Celtics really put on a great show for Paul Pierce, and obviously not the game, but the whole production of Paul Pierce night, from naming the tunnel the Paul Pierce Players Tunnel and giving him that Eddie Palladino introduction, the captain and the truth, Paul Pierce, the whole thing, and getting guys like Doc and Rondo, who are currently in the middle of their own seasons, to come in, and it goes to show what Paul Pierce means to these guys, to get former players, everybody involved, and just the way they did it, the piece that Sean Grandy wrote and Tommy Heinsohn narrated was spectacular, and just the whole night was perfect from top to bottom. And it just goes to show that game that preceded it was just awful. Within 5 minutes of the ceremony, no one cared anymore. It was just all about Paul Pierce. It was just beautiful. It was such a well-deserved honor for Pierce's number to go up in the rafters.
And as you wrote, John, that impressed a lot of people, not the least of which, Gordon Hayward.
Yeah, Gordon Hayward, even Al Horford, those guys who are young stars and see the potential for 6, 7, 8-year career in Boston, those are guys that can kind of envision themselves in that moment. And if those guys, Horford and Hayward, especially Kyrie, because he's younger, if those guys can come in and win a title or two and lead a sustained period of greatness in Celtics history, then there's no reason to believe that their numbers can't go up there. And that's big. When you have that moment, you see the outpouring of emotion from the fans, from former athletes, from former coaches. You see all that and you picture yourself in the middle of it. That's powerful. That's very powerful stuff. So they see it. Other guys see it. Other players around the league see that. And they've seen beyond that, the video tributes that the Celtics have given. That just goes to show that if you can come to this franchise and do well, you will be recognized for the work that you do.
John Corrales talking Celtics on the Best of Downtown. When we come back, you remember the North Pond Hermit, of course. We'll talk with the author of a book all about him. Michael Finkel joins us next. It's the Best of Downtown on Z62 Retro Radio.
At Quirk Motor City, you get a huge selection of quality pre-owned vehicles priced to fit any budget. Plus, the Quirk Motor City pre-owned difference, with a limited warranty that's 3 times longer than the average dealer's pre-owned warranty. Free main state inspections for the life of the vehicle, a free Carfax vehicle history report, and Quirk Motor City's certified pre-owned 118-point inspection. It's your quality pre-owned car. Find it at Quirk Motor City in Bangor, Belfast, Augusta, and Portland. View our pre-owned inventory online at quirkauto.com.
It may not be prime biking season, but it's always a good time to make sure your cycle is in great shape. And there's only one place to go to do that. Slipping Gears Cycling, 753 Stillwater Avenue in Bangor. Bangor's only full-time cycling sales and service experts. They offer outstanding service and a huge stock. Make sure you like them on Facebook to get updates, shop in person or online at slippinggears.com.
Since its founding in 1954, Cross Insurance has grown from a small family-owned agency that started in Bangor, Maine, into one of the largest super-regional insurance agencies in New England. With a network of offices throughout New England, Cross Insurance works with top carriers to provide maximum value to you, your family, and your business. We are proud to be the official insurance broker of the New England Patriots and would welcome the chance to provide security for your team. For more information, visit crossinsurance.com. Cross Insurance, where security meets strength.
It's not always whether you win or lose, but who you've got on your team. The Emily Ellis team at Next Home Experience wants you to enjoy the best team chemistry in real estate. If you're looking to buy, sell, rent, or build in the Bangor area, make Emily Ellis's All-Star Squad your go-to team. Responsive and experienced, the Emily Ellis team will make your real estate quest as smooth as possible. Linda, Jen, Callie, and Emily will listen and prepare your game plan. The Emily Ellis team at 57 Washington Street in Bangor, shooting for your goals.
We walked the loneliest mile. We smiled without any.
We're back on the Best of Downtown, and everybody remembers the story from a few years back about Christopher Knight, known as the North Pond Hermit, who spent 27 years hiding out in the woods of Maine until he was finally apprehended, went to court, and then went on to live his life attempting to adjust to being out among the rest of us human beings. Our next guest, author Michael Finkel, has written a wonderful book about Christopher Knight. It's entitled Stranger in the Woods, and we had a chance to talk with him about it earlier this week on Downtown. Michael, thanks so much for being with us. I love the book. I read it when it first came out, and then with the new release in paperback, went back and read it again, and it's such a compelling story. What was it that drew you to the story of Christopher Knight?
This is like one of these catnip for journalists story. I mean, I don't know if it was like the true crime mystery, the survival story, the philosophy of being alone, the legend, and then like the question of, you know, the great question is, why would you quit the world? And then, you know, what is it like to come back to the world after 27 years of being gone? I mean, how could I not be interested? And, you know, Chris Knight himself is such, you know, whether... no matter how you feel about him, and I know over there in Maine there's many, many opinions, but regardless of how you feel, the man is really intelligent and has some pretty interesting things to say when he does decide to say something.
Yeah, and you talked about the legend, and he was certainly that and more, although, yes, not universally beloved. There were those people, even people whose properties were broken into who were fine and who said throughout the book that even if they had come upon him, they might not have called anybody, but others who took it as a great personal affront felt violated, never felt safe. So even within the North Pond area, there were differing opinions about him.
Yeah, and I find that to be interesting. And just for your probably few listeners who don't know it, I mean, in a nutshell, it's a story about a guy who escaped the world at age 20, abandoned his car at the shores of Moosehead Lake, went into the woods with very little supplies, and didn't come out again for 27 years. Eventually settled into a extraordinary little campsite in the Belgrade Lake area and survived by breaking into second homes in the, you know, the camps around the seasonal camps around the Belgrade Lakes, and you know, had a code, which was no one was home when he broke in, never kicked down a door, broke a window, wouldn't touch your television, your computer, your jewelry, but would take your, you know, your steaks, your Stephen King novel, and your flashlight. And like you said, if you're the type of person who needs all your characters to be black or white, good or evil, you might want a different book. But Chris Knight, to me, he's extraordinary, but there's a lot of shades of gray. He's a thief. He is a survivor. He's an intellectual. He's annoying. You know, I really enjoyed my, you know, I'm speaking to you from my home here in Montana, so I'm familiar with rural countryside and cold winters. And so I always felt wonderfully welcomed in Maine. In fact, I got to tell you, don't tell my Montana friends, I always wanted a coastline in Montana. And you guys had everything Montana has plus a coastline.
We have that, that's for sure, yeah.
I know, we're missing that. So I always felt warmly welcomed, and it was always so much fun to talk to people about the victims of his crime. And there are such varied reactions, you know. Some people were like, yeah, if I'd have caught him, I'd have let him go. And other guys like, you know, I hid out in the dark for 14 days with, you know, with my gun, I was going to take him down. And it was always never less than entertaining. I don't think there was a single person who didn't care. Everybody cared passionately, but in a different way.
What's fascinating, too, for anybody who doesn't know the story, is that all those years, those 27 years, winters as cold as they get in Maine, and he never set a fire because the smoke would, of course, be a signal to other people where he might be.
I'm picturing a couple of your listeners right now shaking their head saying, that is not possible. And I'm going to tell you, I understand where you're coming from. Like I said, I'm here in Montana. Look, I don't want to spend one night in the woods without a big blazing bonfire. I'm telling you, he spent 27 winters out there. He did not sleep in anyone's cabin, and he never lit a fire. I wanted to catch him in a lie. I know that it's unbelievable. I went to his site 7 different times. I just wanted to find a charred piece of wood and be like, aha, you did have a fire. Or I wanted one person, you know, there was dozens of cabins that installed video cameras. Just one person, show me an image of him sleeping in your bed or taking a shower. And nobody could. The man has a lot of quirks about him, but one of his quirks is that he's almost incapable of lying. This is a guy who didn't want attention. This is a guy who didn't even want me to write a book, to be honest with you. He wanted to be anonymous. This isn't a guy who's bragging about a feat that he didn't do. He had an amazing, you know, and for anybody who's interested, we can get into the nitty gritty. Since I like to camp, I was interested in many aspects, but like some of the survival stuff, like, so what did you do to not, like, how did you not lose a toe to frostbite? We went through every little detail, and everything he said made sense. And he came up with it himself. He left the world at age 20, never had an elder's advice again after the age of 20, and survived. He has quite a head on his shoulders.
And even you talk about frostbite and the feet, especially, and it's a little nugget in there deep in the book where he says, dry is better than cold. And his feet at the time would not get warm, but as long as he had dry socks, he felt okay.
Yeah, and for example, let's just get into, you know, I think the number one thing people can't believe is this survival without a fire. I mean, he didn't get sick for 30 years. At first, you don't believe that. Then you talk to a doctor, and you're like, you know, to get sick, you got to have germs or a virus passed from you. And if you don't have people around, you're not going to get sick. 27 years without getting sick. I mean, you can still get things like diabetes or cancer, but never got a cold or anything. But, you know, I asked him, you know, Chris, so at the depth of cold, would you just huddle yourself into like a little ball and just, you know, what I do when I'm cold and I'm camping, you know, I just clutch myself into like a fetal position. And Chris had a funny way of expressing that my ideas were, shall we say, less than intelligent. He would sort of slide his eyes over to me and give me this like long, disappointed blink as in, you know, boy, you know, I could have picked a smarter journalist to talk to. And he's like, that was completely wrong. What Chris Knight would do, and this is just a little nugget, is at about 2 o'clock in the morning on winter nights, which is about the depth of cold, when I'll just speak for myself, when I would be trying to clutch my blankets around me, he would get out of his bed, out of his tent, and put on his shoes, his dry shoes, and walk, pace the small perimeter of his campsite. And he would shovel the snow, so he was literally walled in with snow for months at a time, and pace all night, every night, all winter, every winter, for 27 winters. He paced and paced and paced, and that way kept himself from freezing from hypothermia, and never so much as lost a toenail to frostbite. But boy, think about the toughness and sort of interior drive that you have to do that, not just one night or two nights, but hundreds and thousands of nights.
And as he said, he was worried that if he slipped into that comfort of sleep in those conditions, that he would run the risk of dying right in that sleeping bag.
I mean, I've been talking to, you know, some people around the country, but it's always nice to talk to folks in Maine because I don't have to explain how cold it gets there. You know, these Florida stations, they're like, yeah, it probably gets to like 30 degrees, 45 degrees. I'm like, yeah, you know how it goes there when you get that first snowfall sometimes, you know, before Halloween, and dang, it's May and there's still snow on the ground. You know how long and how cold and how wet and how windy it can get there. And to go all that time, I mean, if you go for a week of camping with fire in winter, I'm pretty impressed in Maine, but, you know, let alone a season and let alone no fire, let alone 27 of them. It is, like I said at the outset, just about impossible to believe. And yet at the same time, completely true. I'm very fortunate as a journalist. I could, I might work 100 years and never come across a richer, more fascinating, more kind of varied story than this one.
We're talking with Michael Finkel, author of The Stranger in the Woods, The Extraordinary Story of the Last True Hermit. And as you point out in the book, it's not unusual, certainly among the Stoics, to make this decision. And look, we all have days when the life of a hermit sounds pretty appealing. But for most people, that's something historically that they might have done at the end of their life. In all your conversations with Chris, did you ever get to the bottom of what made him walk away from society at such a young age?
You're absolutely right. Humans are very, very social creatures, social animals, as you could tell from, you know, watch a human with 7 seconds of free time. What they pick out their phone and look at Twitter. You know, we like to be connected. But there have always been, as you mentioned, throughout history, those who wanted to be apart. And sometimes it was religious reasons, sometimes it was artistic reasons, sometimes it was anger at the world. And there's been some very bright people, scientists, artists, etc. But Chris did leave a lot earlier than most people, and of course I wanted to know why. And his answer, it might sound a little frustrating. He said to me that when he was in high school and a little bit older, he said he never felt comfortable being around other people. He was, and we all know shy people and introverted people, but he had a real extreme case of that. And he felt, I think he described it as something like a gravitational tug. He just felt this desire to be by himself. And it's been a long time since I was 20 years old, but I did a couple of crazy things in my 20s. And he had this just brash idea. He had just purchased, his brother signed a loan with him, poor brother, a brand new car, a Subaru Brat. It was the most expensive thing he had ever purchased in his life. And you figure that's a sign of not someone who's about to like abandon the world, but he abandoned that Subaru Brat in the woods near the shore of Moosehead Lake, and just without nearly enough supplies, just went into the woods and didn't seem to have a plan. So why did he leave? He left because he felt this sort of urge to leave. But I think almost more interesting is why did he stay? Why did he stay? Why didn't you just do a week or a month or even a year? Why decades? In fact, he never came out voluntarily. It was an arrest that brought about. And the reason why he stayed was more interesting to me. He stayed because he really liked it. Did he suffer? Yeah, he was cold and he was hungry, but he expressed a lot of satisfaction, enjoyment, joy from a very rugged an existence that most of us really couldn't imagine, fulfilled him in a way that really struck me when I was talking to him in jail. Like the sort of satisfaction with his life's course rattled me a little bit. It made me question some of my own decisions, and he expressed more satisfaction with his life than frankly most people I just meet in the street and in the world out here.
I was fascinated by the conversation you had with him about environmental noise and the fact that out in the woods, free from distractions and that ever-present hum, that his memory was incredible. And you even talked to some scientific experts who said that in those situations, we can be operating at a much, greater level of brain power.
Now, I'm sure because I'm talking to you in Maine that we got a lot of outdoors folks listening. And I bet you, have you noticed that when you've gone camping or when you spend a lot of time, I think we're kind of like in a better mood. We're like feeling good. And it's not really because we're on vacation. And I'm not going to get too bogged down in science stuff here, but I think that humans are about a 2 million year old species. And we all evolved as hunter-gatherers. Every single one of our senses, our sense of smell, hearing, touch, was honed and is pretty much attuned to being out in nature, to being a hunter. It's only evolution is so much slower than technological revolution. And we're all calibrated to being outside in nature. It's not, there's been scientific studies around the world and they've all said the same thing. We are calmer. You can measure it in the blood pressure and your heartbeat. We are smarter. We are happier when we're out in the woods. And Chris, by hook or by crook or by knowledge or by luck, found himself in the ideal place for maximum brain function. You should hear when he talks about a book he read 25 years ago. It's as if he read it last night. He has like almost total recall. I found it very daunting. I'm not the smartest guy you'll ever meet, but I felt completely outclassed by his mind. And it was another one of the many, many fascinating aspects of working on Chris's story.
Well, he clearly chose this life of stoicism and stuck with it for stoicism, and it stuck with it for years and years. And at one point in the book, you say that he lived for a living. Was he fulfilled by that life in the woods?
Yeah, I mean, again, I'm not forgiving him for being a criminal, but he my encounters with Chris in the story sort of, made me question a few things. He's like, what do you do with your life? You're spending the prime of your life in a cubicle staring at a computer in exchange for money, and that's thought of as good. And I'm spending the prime of my life in a tent breathing good air and just thinking free thoughts, and that's bad. You know, cutting down trees is enterprising. You know, looking at trees is lazy. And he just sort of said a few things that, you know, made me think. And again, Chris did not. He took other people's stuff. They worked hard for a living. I am not unaware of the contradictions here. And in fact, I try to highlight them in the book and let you decide how you feel. But if you're at all curious about extremes of human nature and a local Maine story, you know, he will make you think. He might make you mad. He might make you joyous. He might make you some combination of all three. He's a complicated person. And I didn't shy away from it. In fact, I tried my hardest to bring out all the complications in someone like Chris Knight.
Michael, your last couple of communications with him were very poignant and powerful, and especially that last one, which at least gives us the impression of being hopeful going forward. Do you think it's possible that Chris has been able to find peace in this outside world?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things if you sense from listening to you talk that there's a warmth in my voice about Chris, well, that it is true. I admit it. I do feel warmly about him. I try to be as impartial as possible in writing the book, but there were things that just really amazed me about him. And I did, I admit to you, worry, like, oh my gosh, this is a sensitive individual, whether he's a thief, but he's also quite sensitive. Is he going to be able to survive in the world? And without giving too much away, at first it was extraordinarily difficult, but Chris is a true survivor and also has a strong mind. And I can't be sure. We're no longer in contact. He did not want to be my friend. He told me what he wanted to tell me, and told me to get lost, and I had no choice but to get lost. And so from what I know, he's doing okay. Although I have to tell you, Rich, every once in a while, I think I'm going to hear news that he's disappeared into the woods again. And if I do hear that news, I'll probably have a little small smile on my lips, just as long as he's not stealing from people. He really wasn't built for our world. And, you know, it's one of the sub-themes of the book is, what do you do with someone who's just doesn't fit into the world? If you're a murderer, well, then we got jails for you. If you're completely crazy, we have hospitals for you. But someone who's neither of those things and still doesn't fit in, we just don't have a place for you. And it's one of the sort of melancholy little thoughts that we discuss in the book.
Well, it's such a fascinating story. And for anybody who hasn't read it, out now in paperback, The Stranger in the Woods, the extraordinary story of the last true hermit. You really capture the full story of Christopher Knight. It is a wonderful read. We thank you for being with us. And, I hope that the Cowboys, as Chris would call them, are doing well also.
The Cowboys, he's referring to my children, and they're as loud and non-hermit-like as possible. But thank you for asking. And I really appreciate you having me on the show to discuss this interesting story.
Author Michael Finkel discussing his book, Stranger in the Woods, Best of Downtown, on your Sunday morning, brought to you by Cork Motor City Used Vehicle Center, with locations in Augusta, Bangor, Belfast, and Portland. It's your car. Find it at corkauto.com. When we come back, we go to the movies. Alan Adams of the Maine Edge with movie reviews. Best of Downtown, Z62 Retro Radio.
Go Blue!
Sir, you're here for the cheerleading tryouts?
Yeah, for the class of 82. Gotta show my school spirit.
I know a better way. The UMaine Alumni Signature Rewards Visa Card from University Credit Union. Low rates, no annual fees, and it earns reward points for travel, merchandise, or cash back.
Woo, sounds easier than a backflip.
Apply online today at UMaineAlumniCard.com.
Federally insured by NCUA. Terms and conditions apply, subject to credit approval.
At this busy time of year, there's nothing better than a place that offers you one-stop shopping. That place is G&M Family Market on the corner of Route 1A and Route 46 in Holden. Fresh produce delivered daily, a great selection of meats and seafood, beer and wine, of course a Dunkin' Donuts and an Amato's right on site. Stop into G&M Family Market every day of the week from 6 in the morning till 9 o'clock at night, and if they don't have what you're looking for, they'll make every effort to get it next time. G&M Family Market, Route 1A and Route 46 in Holden.
Hi, this is Mike Toole. My company is ClearPoint Financial. We're an independent retirement plan advisory firm located right here in Bangor, Maine. At ClearPoint Financial, we provide guidance-based, comprehensive retirement plan solutions to companies that are concerned about their employees' retirement income security. We focus on plan participants. We help them strive to achieve retirement income security. We provide ongoing engagement, education, investment advice, and service that exceeds expectation. For more details on our financial wellness programs, call me today at 899-2552. ClearPoint Financial, the official financial advisor of the Maine Black Bears.
Penobscot Theater presents...
My name is Albert Sodi, and have I got a buck story for you.
Come up to camp for a deer hunting tall tale by actor Jeff Daniels.
Takes place in the Sodi Deer Camp, just north of Escanaba, Michigan. That's in the Upper Peninsula, for those of you that don't know nothing.
Escanaba in the Moonlight, February 1st through the 18th at Bangor's Historic Opera House.
There's a couple of things that need to be explained. First is, in the UP, we don't explain things.
Tickets at 942-3333 and PenobscotTheater.org.
Back on the best of downtown for your Sunday morning.
Call you up in the middle of the night, like a firefly without a light.
Up next on the program, a little movie talk from earlier in the week. Alan Adams of the Maine Edge joins us every Monday for Pass the Popcorn. And this time around, Alan reviews Peter Rabbit and the new Clint Eastwood movie, The 1517 to Paris. Well, where do we start with Heroes on a Train or Rabbits?
You know, it's funny. Let's start with Peter Rabbit, because that movie was actually a good deal better than I thought it was going to
be. Wow, I'm shocked, just from the trailers.
Yeah, like, it's one of those things where I'm like, okay, this is ridiculous. And don't get me wrong, like, I'm someone, I have a very deep-seated love of Beatrix Potter and the work that she did, the characters that she created, and all that. So I wasn't necessarily looking for an edgy 21st century update of Peter Rabbit. But... I get it. The reality is there's a very quiet simplicity to the stories of Beatrix Potter that, you know, isn't necessarily all that cinematic, if we're going to be honest right. about it. And so, to sort of bring forth that movie, bring that story onto the big screen in a way that's going to be engaging while still staying relatively true to the character was always going to be tough. I guess I would say it's got spirit, but it doesn't necessarily have as much of the soul of the original as maybe you'd want. But that being said, it's still a relatively entertaining movie. It's Peter Rabbit, voiced by James Corden, he just wants to get into old Mr. McGregor's vegetable garden. That's what he wants. And his partners in crime are his slow-witted cousin Benjamin Bunny, and his sisters Flopsy, Mopsy, and Cottontail, two of whom are voiced by some of the most famous actresses on the planet right now. Flopsy is Margot Robbie, who also narrates the movie, and Cottontail's Daisy Ridley,
wow.
Who was in a little movie you might remember called The Last Jedi. Very recently. But yeah, so he's trying to get into old Mr. McGregor's vegetable garden. And then through circumstances that I'm not going to go into details, it turns out that we discover that old Mr. McGregor, there's a young Mr. McGregor, a long lost great nephew named Thomas, played by Domhnall Gleeson, who's a manager of a toy store in London. And he comes out to McGregor's estate to get things cleaned up and prepare for a possible sale. Meanwhile, McGregor's neighbor, a woman named Beatrix, you know, get it, who has a very loving and tender relationship, affectionate relationship with the forest creatures, played by Rose Byrne. And basically what we get are some pretty supercharged rabbit on human hijinks. Peter and his cohort basically are trying to get rid of Thomas, while Thomas is trying to get rid of them, while still trying to woo B, and unable to overtly get rid of the rabbits and such, because B is friends with the rabbits, and you know, you see how these sorts of complicated relationship dynamics play out. And then, you know, there's a lot of ridiculous slapstick stuff and You know, the animation's great. Bunnies in waistcoats. There's nothing wrong with that. there is. There's been a little bit of controversy surrounding the movie regarding the weaponization of food allergies at one point.
Oh yes, yes.
Which is, it's one of those things where, I mean, I guess I understand. Like, I watched the movie and it was like, and I did, it didn't even occur to me that it would be a thing. But again, I've, you know, I don't, you know, I don't have to, you know, hide from peanut butter when I go to school. So maybe it's different for a kid like that. But yeah, for the most part, I mean, it's silly. Like, it's not a particularly sophisticated movie. There's some pretty good slapstick gags, some, you know, some sort of self-aware moments that are kind of fun, some winks and nods to the grown-ups in the audience. Again, it's not, you know, it's not Beatrix Potter, really. Like, it's, I mean, it's a rabbit wearing a coat and his name is Peter. But after you get beyond that, there's not a ton of resemblance. But it's still kind of fun. Like, I mean, it's not a great movie. It's not going to take its place among the classics of kiddie cinema. But, you know, there are certainly far worse ways to spend a couple of hours with your family.
All right. The other one you saw, the new Clint Eastwood film, the 1517 to Paris, a true story and at least an interesting hook in that the guys who were the heroes play themselves in the movie, even though they have no acting experience.
Yeah, no, it's an interesting experiment. One could argue that it is a noble experiment. What it is not is a successful experiment. It breaks my heart to say it because I think it's an incredibly compelling story. I think these guys are legitimate heroes in the capital H sense of that word. They are not actors. And it shows, you know, and it's one of those things where it's like, I wanted to like this movie because, again, like the story, for those who are unfamiliar, these three Americans were on a train from Amsterdam to Paris. A gunman attempted to open fire in the passenger cars on that trip, and they basically stopped him before he was able to kill anyone. You know, and we're talking about multiple guns, hundreds of rounds of ammunition. Like, they averted what could have been an incredible tragedy. And it was an incredibly brave thing that they did. Bravery does not equal screen presence. You know, and the thing about it, too, was Eastwood went out of his way. He told them specifically not to get any sort of training or to, you know, or anything like that. And I understand that desire to find some sort of authenticity in it, but it just doesn't work. Their names, there's Spencer Stone, Alex Scarlatos, and Anthony Sadler. Those are the gentlemen. You know, their childhood friends grew up together. Their paths sort of diverge a little bit as they grow up. Stone winds up going into the Air Force. Scarlatos joins the Army National Guard. And Sadler goes to college, studies kinesiology. But they decide that, you know, they're going to go out for some sort of one last hurrah and backpack through Europe. So they, you know, they go to Italy, they go to Germany, they go to Amsterdam, and then they decide they're going to go to Paris. And that's when they wind up on this train. Where they're in the right place at the right time to prevent this incredible tragedy. They're not done any favors by either Eastwood's direction, because, you know, if there's one thing Clint Eastwood loves is those long, lingering sort of close-up shots that rely almost exclusively on actor reaction for their impact. Mm. Like, this is it's absolutely the wrong group of people to try to, the marriage of idea and style is so incongruous, and it just doesn't work. And the screenplay, it's by a first time screenwriter. I'm trying to remember her name. Dorothy Bliskell is her name. It's based on the book that Stone, Scarlatos, and Sadler wrote about the event. But it's just it's filled with very flat, very generic dialogue, and that's not helped by, you know, when it's being delivered by guys who just don't have any experience. Mm. Like, you know, they're not uncharismatic by any stretch, you know, and you could see that specifically when we actually reach the incident. Like, the last quarter of the film is actually pretty compelling to watch. because we're not relying on them saying a screenwriter's interpretation of words they remembered saying when they talked to the guy who wrote the book. Right. You know, it's like you're three or four steps removed at that point. And so the personal connection is long gone. But when it's the event itself, like you actually can kind of see, and there's that sort of the heart racing kind of feel to it. So that bit's actually pretty engaging. But the hour plus it takes you to get there, it's like the world's most highly budgeted student film. Like that's what it reads like. It's like it just, you know, exotic locales and whatnot aren't going to save you. And again, like, and you know, these guys, you know, it's not all non-actors. There are some familiar faces in this movie. Judy Greer and Jenna Fisher play Stones and Scarlatos' mothers, respectively. Thomas Lennon is in it. Tony Hale, friend of downtown, PJ Byrne.
Oh yeah,
is in it. But it's one of those things where, again, like they're all sort of hamstrung by a script that's just not very good. And you almost wonder what could have, it's the sort of movie that makes you wonder what could have been, because again, I think it's a really interesting idea that Eastwood had. And for a guy, his age, he's what, 88, something
he's
like that.
I was just looking that up. He's going to be 88 in a couple of months,
you know? And so for a guy who's been doing it for this long and to have this sort of, you know, with this sort of lengthy career, for him to sort of take such an outside the box swing, it's admirable. It really is. But God knows he's as good as they come as far as, you know, sort of rendering the stories of ordinary men doing extraordinary things. Like that's kind of his wheelhouse. But it just doesn't work. And again, it really pains me to say that, because I think it really is an incredibly engaging and compelling and powerful story. And these men are really worthy of being lauded and celebrated in this way. I just wish the movie was better. I guess that's what I keep coming back to. I want it to be good, and it's simply not.
Now, I was trying to think, is this his first film since American Sniper?
He did Sully.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Which,
yeah.
Again, I mean, it's, you know, it would be the equivalent of casting Sully Sullenberger instead of Tom Hanks. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? It's just like, it's an interesting idea on paper. It's like, oh, wow, that's really cool. And then in practice, it's like, oh yeah, no, this is why actors are paid and are trained for years and years to do what they do, because not, you can't just roll in off the street and do it.
Alan Adams of The Main Edge, movie reviews, Pass the Popcorn here on The Best of Downtown. When we return, our retro rock conversations continue. A certified music legend, so many hits over the last 50 years, from Hooked on a Feeling, Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head, another Somebody Done Somebody Wrong song, so many more. The great BJ Thomas next here on Z62 Retro Radio.
When it comes to your health, early detection is the best protection. That's why the St. Joseph Regional Breast Care Center provides 3D mammography to offer better answers and greater peace of mind, identifying problem areas that a standard mammogram might miss. It provides precise images for all women, including those with dense breast tissue. Call 907-1682 to schedule your 3D mammogram at the St. Joseph Regional Breast Care Center. 3D, providing peace of mind for you, your family, and your loved ones.
Since its founding in 1954, Cross Insurance has grown from a small family-owned agency that started in Bangor, Maine, into one of the largest super-regional insurance agencies in New England. With a network of offices throughout New England, Cross Insurance works with top carriers to provide maximum value to you, your family, and your business. We are proud to be the official insurance broker of the New England Patriots and would welcome the chance to provide security for your team. For more information, visit crossinsurance.com. Cross Insurance, where security meets strength.
There's only one way Hartley's Chrysler Dodge Jeep Ram in Newport does business. The right way. Owned and operated for over 60 years by the Hartley family, Hartley's offers the same or even better prices and discounts on vehicles as those offered at mega dealerships. And along with that comes their renowned small dealer service and exceptional attitude toward you, their customers. Hartley's values your business and your trust. You're never pushed, never pressured. No one will chase you around the lot, but no one will ignore you either. Hartley's wants you to feel comfortable at their dealership. So feel free to look around, and Hartley's professional sales staff will always be there when you need help. You'll like the place, you'll like the people, and you'll like the way they do business. The right way. The folks at Hartley's wouldn't do it any other way. Always remember, if you're out there looking around, the best deals aren't in the city, they're in the country. Hartley's Country, at the Triangle in Newport. You'll always be treated the right way at Hartley's.
Your home should be your sanctuary, the place that keeps you safe and warm in the winter and cool and dry in the summer. The people at Penobscot Home Performance want to make sure your home is safe, healthy, comfortable, and energy efficient. They take a big picture view with practical steps and use their experience to ensure that the space and systems in your house are working better together. Contact them today for a free energy consultation by visiting PenobscotHomePerformance.com. Back on the Best of Downtown for your Sunday morning, Z62.
I just can't help believing when she smiles up soft and gentle with a trace of misty morning.
Our next guest on the program has sold over 70 million records over the last 50 years. One of the most recognizable voices in all of music. One of his big hits there from 1970. We had a chance to catch up with B.J. Thomas on Friday and talk about some of his biggest hits and his lengthy career in the music business. B.J., it's been such a remarkable career for you, making great music for well over 50 years now. And I want to go back to the start of your career. You've been making music and recording for some time, but in the midst of the Beatles and the Birds and the Rolling Stones, you hit it big with your first huge hit. And how unusual was it for 1966 for an old Hank Williams song to not only make the charts, but be a million seller?
It was unusual. I'd just been singing with our band, the Triumphs, that we had formed in the late 50s. And, I loved Hank Williams. I saw Hank Williams when I was about eight, 9 years old. Saw him perform. My dad was a huge fan of, Hank's. So there was a movie that was out back when I was young called Your Cheating Heart. It was the life story of Hank Williams.
Oh, with George Hamilton, right?
Yes, with George Hamilton the fourth, and not George Hamilton the fourth. That was but George Hamilton, and Hank Jr. did the vocals for the movie. And it was me and a band member were at the theater, and he just told me, said, that I'm so lonesome thing, we ought to start doing that with the band. And so we did. We started doing it with the band, and it kind of evolved into the version that we did, which was, very different in some parts than the original, of course. And, I put it on the B side of what we thought was a hit record after we recorded our first album. I just put it on the B side, basically for my dad. And of course the A side was not a hit record. and I knew all the disc jockeys, very well. And we were all friends, and they supported us with airplay when they could. And disc jockey by the name of Bob White said, while you're here, let's listen to the other side. They turned it over. It was lonesome, and he loved it and put it on the radio, and it went number one in 3 weeks in Houston, Texas. And I got booked out with Dick Clark, and now I'm talking to you.
Well, it kind of set the tone for a remarkable career where you've succeeded in so many areas with country music, with pop, gospel, Christian music. And I guess that's because a good song is a good song, regardless of any label that might be applied to it.
Well, I think you're exactly right. It also kind of relates to when we started with our band. It was right at the inception of Top 40 radio. And we would, we put up our playlist, and what we were going to do, we just played dances for kids. People of our age at that time out in the boondocks, and that we would just make our playlist up of what they played on the Top 40 radio. And of course that included all the genres, from Mantovani to Elvis Presley and Chubby Checker and Chuck Berry and Little Richard, all those guys. And so we just made our playlist up of that. And I think that's what I never tried to really do different genres, but it just kind of worked out that way. It relates to what you said. A good song is a good song. And of course the gospel music came from a different experience that we had back then. And we got 5 Grammys for our gospel music, and that was pretty cool.
Well, went on to have another huge year in 1968, Eyes of a New York Woman, one of my all-time favorites. And then, when you talk about the great songs in the history of pop music that just sound as fresh today as they did 50 years ago, Hooked on a Feeling, certainly one of those.
Yeah, well, thank you. You know, Hooked is, it would probably be right up with Lonesome, would be my favorite song that I've ever recorded, and I love Hooked, and I know most people come to hear me sing Raindrops, but the most of the time the biggest reaction to the anything we do is to Hooked on a Feeling. And that was a Reggie Young on the electric sitar with the American Studio Group, produced by Chips Mullman. That's when I moved up to Memphis, Tennessee in 67, and we started working at the American Studio and just trying to feel ourselves out there. And the first kind of successful thing we had was the Eyes of a New York Woman. And then we had used the sitar on New York Woman a little bit. And so we've used it in a major way on Hooked on a Feeling. And, you know, it was a big hit for me.
Well, and then even with the big hits you've had, nothing could prepare you for the success, I'm sure, of Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head. Now, is the story I've heard true that one of the reasons they reached out to you is because they thought your voice is what Paul Newman would have sounded like if he could sing?
Well, I think that had something to do with it. And because my childhood buddy back in those days, a guy by the name of Steve Tyrell, was a promotion man, an A&R guy for Scepter Records at that time. And he helped a lot with getting Mr. Bacharach to give me that shot. But I think that's right. I think they thought that would relate to Paul Newman, and even working more so in that direction. I had laryngitis when I did the song for the film. I had been doing a whole string of one-nighters over about a 3-week period in the Midwest, and by the time I got out to California, my throat was just shot. I went to the doctor, and he said, you know, BJ, you've got the worst, you know, laryngitis, you know, I've ever said, worst throat I've ever seen. I said, I don't want you to even speak for 2 weeks. And I said, oh, doc, you know, you got to help me. So somehow he gave me a little medicine, B12, things like that. And, you know, I was able to get through the song a few times, but it was very scratchy. And I think that even worked in my favor. So. And the song, of course, was beautifully received, and you know, one of the first of its kind, really, and won the Academy Award for Mr. Bacharach, and also Mr. Bacharach won for the score. So it was a great, you know, Butch Cassidy was a great movie, and, you know, one of the all-time great westerns, and it was just, you know, the whole thing was just such a pleasure to be involved with, and an honor, really.
We're talking to B.J. Thomas here on Downtown. I want to talk, speaking of Steve Tyrell, about maybe my favorite B.J. Thomas recording, and that's the effort you and Steve put together with the great Barry Mann, Cynthia Weil song, Rock and Roll Lullaby, which on its own was pretty amazing. But you and Steve came up with the idea of honoring some of the great sounds from the past, and that led you to track down people like Darlene Love, Duane Eddy, Dave Summerville, yeah, from the Diamonds, and just a remarkable record.
And Barry Mann played the keyboards, and it was a beautifully conceived production, and mainly credit that to Steve and Al Gargoni, the two guys that produced the album Billy Joe Thomas, and it worked beautifully. You know, it was a million seller in South America and was going to be, you know, it was, I guess it was a top 15 record here in America. But what happened was, as soon as we finished that album and released Rock and Roll Lullaby, the company went bankrupt. So Scepter Records was a great, you know, one of the great independents, and they had some of the major, you know, Dionne Warwick and the Isley Brothers and a lot of great people, but they had financial problems. And at the end of that album, they weren't even able to press records. So a lot of that music kind of went by the boards, but the Rock and Roll Lullaby kind of stands out from that session. Beautifully done, and Darlene Love and the Blossoms and the Chiffons sang back up. And just, great production.
Mid-70s, you moved over to ABC and had one of the biggest hits of your career. Hey, Won't You Play Another Somebody Done, Somebody Wrong song. Went to number one on both the pop and the country charts. And again, the country audience learned that you'd been making songs that were terrific songs that should have been played on country radio for years.
Yeah, that's true. That's when I kind of started getting some country airplay for the first time. And the country, I think, has traditionally rejected people that are too, pop people, even though, Tom Jones and James Taylor have had some success country. But at that time, if you even had the sniff of pop, it was difficult to get airplay country. But Somebody Done Somebody Wrong song got me kind of in their mindset. And I've had a great experience with country music. I always felt like if I sang the right song, country people would think I was country and the pop people would think I was pop. And I don't think pop people looked at Somebody Done Somebody Wrong song any differently than any of my songs, but I think country people did. So I was glad it broke me through there.
When you had big success in the 80s, Whatever Happened to Old Fashioned Love, New Looks from an Old Lover, Two Car Garage, one of my favorites, I think you did on MCA, Everybody Loves a Rain Song.
Yeah, Everybody Loves a Rain Song. It was written by Mark James, the guy that wrote Hooked on a Feeling, and The Eyes of a New York Woman for me. It was, it wasn't very successful, but I think there was, it kind of came during the gospel period and the country awakening to my stuff. And that sometimes we did the gospel record, and the gospel records were so big, they were all platinum albums, and they were so big that people began to get the perception that, that I was a gospel singer. And I was a minister and things like that. So country and pop radio kind of had an idea that what I was doing then was gospel. And, I kind of lost some of the attention that I'd always had in that area. But Rain Song, I always expected it to be a big record. It wasn't really big, but I still think it was I loved Mark James' material, and he's one of my best friends, and he's written a lot of songs for me, so I was happy to do it.
You had so much success with the gospel, with Christian music, a winner of several Dove Awards. How important has your faith been to you through these many years?
Well, I do have a faith, because Gloria and I and we live by a certain faith, but we're not religious by any stretch of the imagination. That we had I guess what people have always considered a religious awakening, but we've had a wonderful spiritual life, and our spiritual beliefs have enabled us and strengthened us and helped us through the years in our way.
I would say, too, of all the great success you've had in the entertainment business, I don't know that anything could compare with the fact that you and Gloria recently celebrated, I believe, your 49th anniversary.
Yeah, we got 50 years next year. We're excited about that. And, Gloria's been, I never would have ever been able to, survive without Gloria. And she always could see me for who I was and not exactly who I was being and who I thought I was. I had my problems with alcohol and drugs, and
And she always could see the end of the, you know, the light at the end of the tunnel. And she, you know, she helped me really see the world and see life for what it really was. So, you know, we've had a, that's been the most important thing, of course, in my life. And we've had a beautiful, wonderful marriage, and we can't wait for next year. But 49 is good enough.
We're talking with BJ Thomas here on Downtown. Still recording, still touring, still making great music. I love the album you did with the great producer Kyle Lenning and some wonderfully talented collaborators, the Living Room Sessions, revisiting some of your biggest hits, but finding a way to make them all new again.
Well, we took a kind of more relaxed thing to it. We were resistant to and Kyle Lenning, great producer, great guy, and he did a wonderful job. And we kind of resisted the idea to recut the records again, but the acoustic angle kind of worked with us, and so we did it basically electric free, and it was a lot of fun to do. But we had future projects with that a particular situation in mind when we did that, and we kind of did that as a way to say, hey, we're still here. And but the follow-up record did not materialize, but I am hopefully going to have that record ready by the fall. And we've got a good project in mind. We've got some great songs, and so I hope to get that done by then.
And your voice sounds as good as ever, maybe even better. I was watching, I think it was the clip from the Grammy Hall of Fame with you and Steve Terrell, and man, your voice sounds good.
Oh, man, thank you. Thank you. Well, you know, it takes a little work. I got to, I have to, you know, treat myself right and get rest and whatever. Because, you know, when you're traveling on the road, there never seems to be an opportunity to get any sleep. So I've got to stay as healthy as I can. I've been very lucky there. I've got good genes, and you know, I've been lucky.
Well, your music, part of the memories for a couple of generations of people now, and new ones being added all the time. BJ, thank you so much for more than 50 years of wonderful music and for making time for us.
Well, hey, brother, I appreciate it. I thank you for, you know, playing my music and being interested in me over all these years. And I appreciate my fans out there, and thank you for helping me do what I do. And hopefully I'll talk to you again soon.
That's BJ Thomas, a retro rock conversation. Speaking of that, more retro rock talks coming up every afternoon this week on Downtown. Tomorrow, Hall of Fame drummer Hal Blaine of the Wrecking Crew. Tuesday, Mark Volman of the Turtles. On Wednesday, former Eagles guitarist Don Felder. Thursday, Petula Clark. I mean, she sings our theme song, for goodness sakes. And on Friday, singer-songwriter Stephen Bishop. All coming up this week, Retro Rock Talks on Downtown. That's going to wrap it up for us in the best of Downtown for this Sunday morning. Thanks to BJ Thomas, author Michael Finkel, Alan Adams of The Main Edge, and John Corrales. Tomorrow on the program, we're live, providing, you know, a relapse from either one of us here. We're better. We're healthy now, right?
Yes, let's go with that.
We put that behind us, any sickness. We need to. We've got a busy week. Starting with tomorrow, jam-packed with goodness, including Chad Finn of the Boston Globe, Maine baseball coach Nick Durba, Alan Adams of the Main Edge, stop coughing, Gary, Michael of the Portland Press Herald, attorney report from Mark Cowlin of Eastern Maine Sports, and the aforementioned Hal Blaine talking about some of the biggest hits of the 60s and 70s that he was a part of in another retro rock conversation. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday. Thanks for being with us. We'll catch you tomorrow afternoon at 4 right here on Z62 Retro Radio.
You're gonna be all right now.